And now the latest guidelines in direct response to ESAFNET4 will be recommending that every new atrial fibrillation patient is started on rhythm control even within 1 year of their diagnosis. So this is a bit of a paradigm shift in our field.
That's Dr. Rachida Navarra, an electrophysiologist trained at Washington University before she became the founder of SafeBeatRx with a mission to improve rhythm disorders using machine learning. I'm Dr. Shreya Trivedi. Welcome to the Core IM Thigh Pearls podcast, bringing you high-yield, evidence-based pearls.
And I'm Dr. Hannah Knaus, an internal medicine resident at Beth Israel. As Dr. Navarra alluded to, the focus of this episode will be the Pandora's box in rhythm management in atrial fibrillation.
Yes, let's dive into the pearls we'll be covering today. Test yourself by pausing after each of the five questions. Remember, the more you test yourself, the deeper your learning gains.
Pearl one, rhythm control.
What are the benefits of early rhythm control over rate control alone?
Pearl two, electrical cardioversion.
When's electrical cardioversion used, and what information does it tell us?
Pearl 3, class 3 antiarrhythmics and side effects.
What side effects should we monitor for when it comes to medications like amiodarone, dofetilide, and sotalol?
Pearl 4, class 1C antiarrhythmics and side effects.
What side effects should we watch out for when it comes to medications like propafenone and flecainide?
Pearl 5, catheter ablation.
When should catheter ablation be considered in patients with atrial fibrillation? Okay, Hannah, I don't know about you, but I was pretty surprised to hear at the top of the episode that now rhythm control is first line for new AFib within a year of diagnosis.
I know, especially since we've all probably heard the AFFIRM trial dropped at some point in our training. And I know this isn't journal club, so I'll try to be brief. But AFFIRM is the 2002 landmark trial that set this paradigm that rate control was better than rhythm control.
Interestingly, if you look at AFFIRM and some of these larger trials that led us to believe rate and rhythm control are equivalent, when specifically doing a sub-analysis looking at patients who were receiving rhythm control and receiving drug medication, there is actually a mortality benefit that can be seen in those patients as well. So while it didn't make the headline as far as the trial outcome, it's important to realize that all along, you know, intuitively, right, patients who are in sinus compared to in an abnormal rhythm most of the time fare better in terms of major adverse cardiac events.
So now the reason that rhythm control did not make the headline in the AFFIRM trial was that there was a bunch of issues with the way the trial was set up. So for example, a significant number of patients on antiarrhythmic agents didn't actually achieve sinus rhythm. And anticoagulation could be discontinued in the rhythm control group after 4 weeks in sinus rhythm, but was mandated in the rate control group.
So it sounds like it was definitely worthwhile to re-explore rhythm control. And to think about just that, we sat down with Dr. Eric Bartowski, an electrophysiologist at Ascension St. Vincent's in Indianapolis and consulting professor of medicine at Duke.
Now fast forward to several studies that have analyzed early sinus rhythm, okay? There's the AFib study. There's been several studies that have looked at this, and everyone's been consistent that attacking things early to maintain sinus, regardless of the method you do, is a good long-term goal for the patient. They do better. They look at multiple endpoints, death and stroke and heart failure and certainly quality of life indices in almost every study.
The study he's referring to is the EAST-AFNET4 trial. This study randomized patients with recently diagnosed AFib with a median of 36 days from diagnosis to either rhythm control or usual care, which typically involved rate control. The rhythm control group had a lower risk of death from cardiovascular events, stroke, heart failure hospitalizations, and acute coronary syndrome.
So it sounds like in EAST-AFNET4, rhythm control as early as 1 month from a new AFib diagnosis lowered the risk of mortality from cardiovascular events, which is a big deal. Hannah, this is all great, but I can't help but ask, why is sinus superior?
Yes, I love this question. To understand the answer to this, we have to look at two major buckets of atrial fibrillation management: structural dysfunction and symptoms.
Okay, let's start with structural dysfunction, which, just to make sure we're on the same page, structural dysfunction is just a fancy card's word of saying cardiomyopathy.
And I really liked how Dr. Xu Yang, an electrophysiology fellow here at BIDMC, explained just how intertwined AFib and cardiomyopathy can be.
There are a couple phenotypes. They're the people that have atrial fibrillation. It's new onset. They're relatively healthy, or they don't have a lot of other risk factors. And all of a sudden, they have a terrible systolic myopathy in the setting of atrial fibrillation. Then there are the people that sort of, they have AFib. It progresses over time, and they probably remodel. And they have this, it's more of a smoldering drop of their EF. Their EF goes from 55 to 50 to 45, and eventually it goes down, or it's over a year. So there's sort of these phenotypes. So clearly there's some remodeling that happens. But I think in the setting of the first person, right, there might be something else that's predisposing that person developing cardiomyopathy. So AF in that situation could be a cause, but it could simply just be a decompensating factor, right? And we know that because people who really rely on that atrial kick, and when you take it away and you put them in AF, they develop heart failure. So, you know, a lot of these studies, it's hard to tell, as always, like chicken or the egg. Do you treat atrial fibrillation to prevent the cardiomyopathy, or do you treat it to prevent it as a trigger for decompensation of a baseline cardiomyopathy?
Oh, wow. You know, Shreya, I did not appreciate the complex interplay between AFib and heart failure before making this episode.
Yeah, same. And what he was saying about atrial kick reminded me of a patient I had recently. He previously had a normal EF, some diastolic dysfunction, but when he went into atrial fibrillation from sinus, his ejection fraction dropped to 43%. He actually came in because he was taking a long walk and then syncopized and got hypotensive.
Wait, how did you know that it was his atrial kick that causes hypotension and syncope?
Yeah, so it wasn't me. It was an astute cardiologist that looked back at his old echo and saw that when this patient was in sinus, a significant portion of his left ventricular filling was with atrial contraction. So when he went into AFib and lost that atrial kick, he became hypotensive.
Wow, what a great story. In addition to losing that atrial kick, AFib can also remodel the heart in other ways too. So for example, it can lead to fibrosis, changes in atrial size, and even reorganize the electrical conduction system too.
All structural changes that are no bueno. And while we're on the topic of structural changes, I think we should mention how the ventricles can take quite a hit, right? Especially with those fast heart rates that we might see in AFib. And I still can't stop thinking about the story that Dr. Proskowski shared with us about tachymyopathies.
There was a young woman who had shortness of breath over the weekend, and she came to see another physician, and she was in a rapid left bundle branch block tachycardia, it going at a rate of around 240 a minute, and she was cardioverted. And now she knew exactly when it started. It was like 3 days or 4 days, I mean, because she had been fine before that. She had an ejection fraction of 35%. Okay. Now, no one knew her previous ejection fraction, but they had already done a cardiac cath, as typically happens, and it was normal. But anyway, within a week or so now in sinus rhythm, her EF had gone up to about 55 or 60%. So that patient developed a tachymyopathy within less than a week. So that was a learning point for me.
This was a learning point for me too. It's actually crazy. After having this interview, I saw a patient whose EF dropped from 55% down to 33% after just 1 week of having heart rates in the 130s to 140s range. It really cemented just how fast and serious tachymyopathies can be.
The key is prevention, right? So if you see somebody in that initial office visit who is having rapid rates, you don't have time to mess around. It's not one of these things like, come back, I'll do a Holter, I'll see you in 3 weeks. That's a mistake. Because you don't know if that person's at risk, and it's just not worth taking a chance.
Yeah, so it sounds like we gotta do everything to prevent cardiomyopathy. One, making sure they're not too tachycardic, and two, keeping them in that sinus rhythm.
Okay, so why don't we get into the final bucket of why sinus is superior? Symptoms. But before we get into how sinus helps with symptoms, we have to recognize that most of the time, our patients' symptoms are often subtle and not the textbook palpitations we learn about.
And you realize now that he's had all these symptoms. No, he didn't have his heart racing out of his chest. No, he wasn't passing out and having chest pain and shortness of breath. But fatigue, not thinking clearly, sort of fogginess and stuff, are all these subtle symptoms that if you don't take the time to really dig, they'll just blow right by you.
And what really stood out to me is that sometimes patients don't even realize that they're having those subtle symptoms until they're cardioverted to sinus.
I've had patients swear to me that they were fine, and I've cardioverted them, and they come back, and they say, I never felt better, doc. And I said, how can you never feel better when you felt fine before? You know, I didn't even realize I didn't feel good. You know, I became used to that.
Oh man, this really motivates me to get patients into sinus. Them not knowing how good they can potentially feel. I mean, like, gosh, is that not what life and why a lot of us became clinicians, right? To help patients reach their potential. I'm all about this. I can get on this bandwagon.
Shreya, I love that. We need that positive energy.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so let's recap here then on this good note. The new 2023 guidelines recommend rhythm control within a year of a new AFib diagnosis to improve cardiovascular outcomes and even mortality. And if we break down why sinus is more superior, it really comes down to preventing cardiomyopathy and that adverse cardiac remodeling that happens the longer that someone's in that atrial rhythm.
And I'll add too that next time I have a patient AFib, I'm going to make sure that I ask about the subtle symptoms like fatigue and brain fog.
So now we have a good case for why sinus is superior. There are now so many interventions to think through. Electric cardioversion, ablation, chemical cardioversion with the antiarrhythmic meds. And before this episode, I didn't really have a good framework for why electrophysiology might recommend this thing versus that thing and how to explain that to patients.
Same. So let's dive into one of the ways we can get patients to sinus. We'll start with electrical cardioversion.
So the cardioversion, I describe it to patients as when your computer freezes, you push down on that power button, you hold it down, and it restarts the computer. It fixes the problem right there and then, but it does nothing to prevent a recurrence of the problem. And it's always worth it as a first try, right? That's our first go-to whenever there's an issue and your computer freezes.
That is crazy for me to hear, that electrical cardioversion is just this reset button and doesn't do anything to actually prevent recurrence of AFib.
But one thing I did learn was yes, while electrocardioversion won't keep someone out of AFib long term, it can be helpful in multiple other ways.
Oh yeah, how's that, Hannah?
Yeah, so let's say you have a patient who's acutely unstable with hemodynamic changes that is driven by their AFib, or maybe they're quite symptomatic. These are the patients who can't wait for a drug load or ablation and need immediate conversion to sinus.
Right, so it sounds like electrocardioversion makes sense in uncontrolled atrial fibrillation that's leading someone to be hypotensive, or they're symptomatic and having a lot of palpitations or something like that.
Yeah, so that's a therapeutic use for it. But electrical cardioversion can also be used diagnostically. It can unmask symptoms like we talked about in Pearl 1, and the patient's response to cardioversion can actually help set the stage for how hard this AFib may be to get back into sinus.
It can give you both diagnostic and therapeutic value, because the diagnostic value is, you know, are they somebody that I cardioverted and they go right back into atrial fibrillation, right? Do they have early return of AFib? That's a category of patient who's probably going to be more persistent, who's probably going to need, you know, medications and ablation. But some people, you know, you cardiovert them, they feel better. And if this is the first time they've ever had AFib and they're very symptomatic with, they don't have AFib for like another 9 months or 12 years, we tell everybody this is a chronic condition. It's going to come back. But the cardioversion is diagnostic in that A, it'll tell us if you feel better in a regular rhythm, and then B, your response to that cardioversion is going to tell us what may or may not be necessary to treat you as a person.
So electrocardioversion can also, sounds like, give us prognostic information. If someone gets cardioverted and flips right back into AFib soon after, we're thinking, gosh, this is going to be someone who needs ablation and maybe more meds on board to keep them in sinus, which we're going to cover in the rest of our pearls.
If you cardiovert them and they go into sinus and they're maintaining sinus and they're like, geez, doc, I feel a lot better, I'm going to say, look, it's probably worth it for us to try at least a medicine, if not an ablation procedure, to try and maintain sinus rhythm.
Yeah, so if patients do better in sinus, it gives us a lot of motivation to try to keep them in sinus as much as possible with all the other things we have in our toolkit.
Yes, and then before cardioverting, there's a few other things we have to consider.
They need to be anticoagulatable. And even for people with CHADS VASCs of zero, they need to be on unbroken anticoagulation for 3 weeks before, and usually it's about a month afterwards, just because it's just simply the mechanical electrical dissociation, right? Even though you're physically, you're electrically in sinus rhythm, your atrium may not mechanically completely transform to sinus rhythm until weeks later, during which point you're at very high risk for stroke.
Yes, so maybe electrically things are starting from the sinus node, but possibly not all the HO cells are in sync yet.
It's so interesting to think about the P wave that's upright in lead two is just saying, okay, yeah, the sinus node is on point, but doesn't necessarily tell us about what all the other atrial cells are doing and if they're all coordinated. So if we need people to be anticoagulated for 3 weeks and a month afterwards, what about the people that come in, you know, rushing the emergency room, they're unstable, they're not anticoagulated, they can't wait. What about those people?
Yeah, great question. So that's when we start thinking about a transesophageal echocardiogram or a TEE. Immediately before the cardioversion. This would allow us to see if we can directly visualize if clots there in the left atrial appendage.
One important factor, I think, with any electrical cardioversion consideration is that without intervening on the underlying arrhythmia mechanism, the cardioversion is just a band-aid. So we have to really equip patients to be in their most optimal state so that a electrical cardioversion will provide longer-term benefit. So what does that mean? Basically, patients should be on an antiarrhythmic drug, especially if it's their second or third occurrence of atrial fibrillation, so that they could be held in sinus rhythm once the electrical cardioversion occurs. So that's one consideration. If a patient is in acute decompensated heart failure, then there may be room to optimize their volume status before providing an electrical cardioversion.
So it's like asking, how can I set this patient up for their best chance to stay in sinus rhythm? Is there some other stress going on in their left atrium? Like, is it overloaded? Does it need diuresis? Or do they need antiarrhythmic meds on board, which we'll get to more in the next pearl?
Yeah. So let's recap that electrocardioversion. One strong indication for electrocardioversion is if someone's hemodynamically unstable or they're quite symptomatic from their AFib. And then on the other end, if someone is stable and we want to cardiovert them electrically, we need to ask ourselves, one, has this patient or can this patient be anticoagulated for at least 3 weeks? Or do they need a TEE before their cardioversion? Two, are they medically optimized, particularly how's their left atrium doing and what else do we need to do to give their left atrium the best chance that sinus sticks? And three, depending on the patient's case, we'll likely need antiarrhythmics on board.
And then electrocardioversion will tell us, one, how are their symptoms once they're in sinus? And two, based on how quickly they convert back to AFib, because again, remember, we're just resetting the computer, but not fixing the underlying issue, we can then understand how hard this AFib will be to keep in sinus.
You know what I'm thinking about, Hannah, is if we're going to see more and more patients on these rhythm control meds, I think it's in all our best interest to get comfortable with these meds, when one may be indicated versus the other, and particularly what their side effects may be as we're going to see more and more people on them.
Yeah, and I can feel like there's a ton of antiarrhythmic meds. I mean, we have amiodarone, sotalol, dofetilide, flecainide, and propafenone, among many others.
Yeah, it's like it can be a little overwhelming. Black box on black box on black box all around.
Yes.
So why don't we break this down into two pearls? Maybe that'll be a little bit more digestible. In this pearl, why don't we cover the common class 3 antiarrhythmics, amiodarone, dofetilide, and sotalol?
Yeah, so let's start with amiodarone, one of our commonly used antiarrhythmics. And here, just to clarify, we're talking about oral amio, not IV.
Yeah, amio, I feel like, gets a bad rep, right? It's notorious on board questions, and we see side effects all the time. But I was actually surprised some electrophysiology people actually like to reach for it because it doesn't work right away.
I think this is a useful pearl. Probably the only antiarrhythmic medication I would be comfortable starting somebody de novo who's never, I don't really know about when they're already in AFib is amio. You know, if they're, because you have no idea how they're going to respond to the antiarrhythmic when they cardiovert, right? Because frankly, a lot of people who have AFib who've been in a while have a transient stunning of their sinus node and they have these conversion pauses and they can pass out. Right? And God forbid you give a pretty healthy 55-year-old flecainide, he's out driving and all of a sudden he cardioverts and he has a pause, he faints and he goes to get into a car accident. So amio is a little bit more of a gradual drug that doesn't load as quickly. Right, it doesn't have that immediate cardioversion effect.
Which can also be useful if you pair amiodarone with something like electrical cardioversion that we discussed back in Pearl 2.
we'll preload these patients with amio for a couple of weeks and bring them in for a cardioversion 2-3 weeks down the road when the amiodarone effects start to set in. And then you get sort of the amio prevent, the cardioversion gets them out of AFib, and then the amio holds them out of AFib.
So it sounds like since amio is slower onset than the other antiarrhythmics, it makes it safer to load outpatient. There's lower risk of spontaneous cardioversion and that associated stunning that can make someone pass out. These are all good short-term benefits. What about the long-term use of amio?
Long-term amio use, you really need to look at those side effects. I know I'm so used to writing my notes to check the QTC interval and also those FTs, the PFTs, LFTs, and TFTs.
There is the risk of the pulmonary toxicity, which is reversible. There's the risk of bad amio-associated liver injury, but that's quite rare. Most of these side effects are sort of, again, these chronic smoldering side effects because it makes sense. It takes a while to build up amio in your system, and the more adipose tissue you have, the longer it takes to reach a steady state.
All right, so it sounds like amio is both slow to get started and also slow and taking time to build up and kind of having these smoldering side effects.
Yes, so it's definitely not a preferred agent for those who are younger or those who have liver or lung disease. In these patients, amiodarone should not be the end game.
Anytime that you see a patient on amiodarone, the first question is to ask, well, can we take it off? Can we change it to a different drug? Can we refer to cardiology or EP to consider them for an ablation or something that can save them from being on amiodarone?
Yep. So a lot of good things to think through when you see someone on amio. And just as a quick recap from the pros of amio, though, it can be a slower cardioverter relative to some of our other antiarrhythmics. And this allows for a safe load outpatient, which may work hand in hand with a planned electrical cardioversion.
Nice. All right. Now let's move on to the two other class three antiarrhythmics, dofetilide and sotalol. I think these meds are like truly a black box for most. And we did our best to try to narrow down, I think, 5 key points for internists, right, Hannah?
Yes. I love narrowing it down to key points.
Simplify, simplify, simplify.
So let's start off with the first point. So unlike amiodarone, both sotalol and dofetilide can have quicker times to conversion. So we need to watch out for those conversion pauses, which can make people pass out.
Ah, no bueno. Okay. And then similarly, the second thing we need to watch out for is QTC prolongation. Yes, it rears its head again, but this time it requires a lot more hands-on monitoring. And I will say, though, everyone's practice is a little bit different.
For sotalol and dofetilide, the biggest adverse effect that we watch for is QTC prolongation. And so that's why patients are very frequently monitored with 12-lead ECGs in a scheduled way, 2 hours after each dose during the initial titration period.
So the classic management is to monitor QTC interval for 3 days with serial EKGs, often in the inpatient setting, and then every 3 to 6 months outpatient.
Yeah, and of course, that can be more frequent if someone's already on other QTC prolonging meds. And of course, this also means checking people's electrolytes, making sure their magnesium's good, all that good stuff.
And sure, I'm going to add one little caveat that's unique to sotalol. Sotalol is actually more potent at slower heart rates. So in our patients who are more prone to bradycardia, we need to look for an increased risk of torsades.
Ugh. Speaking of torsades, one of our peer reviewers, Dr. Robert Knotts, mentioned that dofetilide actually just increases risk of torsades all around, that some EP groups don't even touch dofetilide if they don't have to.
Oh, interesting. But of course, everyone's practice is different.
Yeah, absolutely. Third thing to keep in mind about sotalol and dofetilide is that they're renally cleared. So it's not as great for our patients with progressive chronic kidney disease. Sotalol is actually contraindicated in GFRs less than 40, and dofetilide is contraindicated in GFRs less than 20.
Yes. And fourth, the most surprising learning point for me is that if a patient misses 2 or more doses of sotalol or dofetilide, they need to be reloaded in the hospital.
Oh, man. So say somebody's been stable on dofetilide for years and they miss a couple of doses. Maybe they ran out of meds. They didn't get their refill on time. Are you saying, Hannah, that they need to be readmitted, possibly to be reloaded?
Oh, unfortunately, Shreya, I am.
Yeah, I just think about all the patients that come in whose meds we hold, and all the times probably dofetilide and sotalol has been held before.
The half-life of these medications is within that 12-hour span. So they would need to be retitrated starting from the baseline dose all over again if the drug is held for 2 doses. So one consideration I would say there is, unless the patient is having an AKI or they are having aggressive nausea and vomiting and their electrolytes are imbalanced, then do continue the antiarrhythmic drug. And of course, this usually involves a quick call to cardiology or EP consult to ensure the safety of continuing the drug and also reassessing the QTC at that point. But in general, I think it's more often that I see the drug is held when it should be continued as opposed to stopped.
So this is a learning point for me. And I think I'm definitely going to do additional counseling with my patients on sotalol and dofetilide, you know, kind of making sure they know that it can't be skipped. And if they miss their doses, they should really let their cardiologist know as soon as possible.
True. And one final point that I'll add is that there's numerous drug-drug interactions we should watch out for, particularly with dofetilide.
It requires a very, very in-depth look at the patient's medication list because a lot of medications are contraindicated with dofetilide. Tons of HIV medications, a lot of antifungals, antibiotics, thiazide diuretics are contraindicated.
So with these antiarrhythmics, it's worth double checking with a pharmacist, or honestly, I should probably just expect a call from pharmacy because they're often quicker than me.
Yes, I think I have a personal line at pharmacy by now.
I know. Great colleagues.
Yes. So to summarize, patients who are on dofetilide or sotalol, we should check an EKG, potassium, and magnesium because of the QTC prolonging effect. Unfortunately, patients with progressive CKD may not be good candidates for sotalol and dofetilide since there are absolute GFR cutoffs. And if they've missed two or more doses, they may need inpatient monitoring while they're reloaded.
Wow, starting these meds are a big deal. Okay, let's move on to class 1C antiarrhythmics, specifically flecainide and profafenone. And you mentioned earlier that these drugs tend to have faster conversion to sinus.
Yes, and the onset can be so rapid that flecainide or profafenone can be given as a pill-in-the-pocket approach.
Oh.
So with this, select patients who are rarely in AFib and can feel when they are, they pop in a pill of flecainide, profafenone, and then the idea is that it converts them back to sinus, hopefully within a few hours after taking the medication.
Interesting. Like so convenient, right? Like actually can save them a trip to the hospital.
Yeah, exactly. And it can also be used long-term too, not only as a pill-in-the-pocket approach.
Okay, good. So it sounds like flecainide, profafenone sound great. And I know I've had EP friends say they try to reach for it as first line. But the biggest limitation, especially in our complex sick patient populations, is that flecainide and profafenone are not that great in patients with quote-unquote structural heart disease.
Yeah, I heard that too, and which got me thinking, I mean, how do we actually define structural heart disease? Is it just heart failure patients, or is it also include patients with coronary disease?
There's the technical definition, and there's the clinically conservative definition, and then there is the clinical cowboy definition. But I would say that for most people, it's anyone with an abnormal EF, anybody with prior coronary disease, right? And they're not candidates because of the CAS trial, where we gave people flecainide and enkenide, a derivative or relative of flecainide, to suppress PVCs. And they suppressed PVCs amazingly, but then it triggered, probably helped organize some VF or ischemic PVCs into more sustained ventricular arrhythmias. Basically, flecainide and enkenide killed people who were ischemic. So We've expanded that to anyone with a structural heart issue probably should not take flecainide.
And just to make sure that we're on the same page, by ischemic, he means people with prior infarcts.
Okay. So it sounds like it was all really from the CAS trial that found a significant increase in lethal ventricular arrhythmias on patients on flecainide and enkenide versus placebo. And now there's a black box warning for class 1C antiarrhythmics because of that pro-arrhythmic effect.
And Shreya, also worth noting is that class 1C antiarrhythmics are more potent at faster heart rates. So once we have our patients and they're fully loaded on their flecainide or profafenone, we need to do a stress EKG to get their heart rate up and see if their QRS widens, which may indicate a proarrhythmic risk.
So once they're stable on these meds, we actually subject them to a stress test to see what their QRS does on these higher heart rates.
Exactly. And there is another arrhythmia that we should be looking out for in patients on flecainide and profafenone.
These drugs can sometimes alter the atrial repolarization enough to where the patient can actually now conduct better in atrial flutter and go one-to-one, meaning every time their atrium has an impulse, the ventricle is following suit.
So flecainide profafenone can actually promote AFib or flutter conducting one-to-one, which can get really fast.
the important thing to remember there is if you see a patient on flecainide or propafenone, make sure that they also have a rate control agent on board at the same time.
Okay. So it sounds like I'm going to look at the med rec on patients on flecainide or propafenone, make sure they're on a beta blocker or calcium channel blocker, make sure it wasn't discontinued on admission and held, which also happens. And anything else we should round out on flecainide and propafenone?
Yes, there's one less talked about side effect of flecainide, and that's vertigo. I was surprised to learn that vertigo affects nearly one out of every five patients on flecainide.
Oh, that's a lot. Like, lot enough to like add to our vertigo schema.
Yeah.
All right, let's recap then. The past maybe two pearls, and maybe I'll try to reorganize these meds, thinking about indications and contraindications to maybe cement it in a little bit of a different way. So say we have a patient who does not have heart failure, does not have obstructive coronary disease or prior infarcts. This is somebody we may see on flecainide or propafenone. It's quick onset, it's effective, but anyone who gets started on flecainide or propafenone, it buys them two things. One, a stress EKG to see what their QRS does at faster heart rates, and two, it buys them a rate control agent since these meds are pro-arrhythmogenic.
And then maybe your patient has some prior infarct but does not have chronic kidney disease. Then you might see them on sotalol or dofetilide. These are meds that need close monitoring of the QTC interval, sometimes for 3 days inpatient, as well as electrolyte and kidney function monitoring. I'm definitely going to make sure I counsel my patients to not miss any doses of their sotalol or dofetilide.
Yeah, and then last but not least, we have our good old friend amiodarone. Not as fast of a cardioverter, which sounds like can be beneficial in the outpatient setting since it doesn't carry that risk of conversion pauses like we see with the other meds.
And another thing I'll add is that with all these medications, patients still need to be anticoagulated because there is a stroke risk when they convert to sinus.
Ah, so no free lunch when it comes to anticoagulation.
And that leads us to our final pearl, ablation. I'll be honest, I didn't have a great understanding of when to refer patients for ablation or who would be best fit for the procedure.
Yeah, sometimes I think of ablation as like a last resort option when people have failed medical management. But as we heard from our discussants, ablation can be considered in all stages of AFib.
So absolutely, study after study after study has shown that ablation to keep someone in sinus versus drugs wins.
And these studies, such as the early AF and the stop AF trials, have been so compelling that the new guidelines recommend ablation as a first-line treatment in patients with paroxysmal symptomatic AFib within 1 year of diagnosis.
Ah, oh, really? Interesting. Why is it beneficial in paroxysmal AFib, and what's so special about the paroxysmal nature of it?
People with paroxysmal atrial fibrillation in particular, it is more of a quality of life measure.
We see more favorable ablation outcomes when a patient is closer to their time of diagnosis. And so we see better outcomes from a first-time ablation when a patient is in paroxysmal AFib, so coming in and out, versus persistent. And so if you leave atrial fibrillation alone long enough, it tends to become persistent. And so that's really one of the benefits for early intervention and early referral as well for AFib.
Okay, so it sounds like ablation can be beneficial in symptomatic paroxysmal AFib, because the sooner you do ablation, the more effective it is in keeping people in sinus, and it can improve their quality of life, especially if they're flipping in and out of AFib.
And there is another common group of patients that we do have a class one recommendation for ablation for, and that's in patients who have AFib and heart failure with reduced ejection fraction.
And over time, all the studies have now shown if you have decreased heart function, that you will do better in sinus. And ablation is the easiest way to keep you in sinus. It's not the only way. I mean, but sinus is better. So if somebody is in those situations, yes, I'm going to push them more towards an ablation because the data are out there suggesting they'll benefit a lot.
Huh. I had no idea that in patients with a reduced ejection fraction, that catheter ablation over antiarrhythmic meds alone actually had a mortality benefit and actually less heart failure hospitalizations in various trials.
So just to recap, the two populations we have strong data to support early catheter ablation in is those with newly diagnosed paroxysmal AFib, as well as in those who have heart failure with reduced ejection fraction.
All right, but then what about our patients with persistent AFib or they have a normal systolic function? Do we consider ablation in them?
Okay. So this is where the art of medicine comes in, and there's really no right answer. I mean, yes, we have to keep in mind that the longer someone is in AFib, the harder it'll be to get them back into sinus.
AFib does beget more AFib. And Makes sense, right? The longer they're in AFib, the larger the left atrium can be, and the harder it'll be for that ablation to be effective.
Exactly. And all that is to say, though, that no matter how persistently someone has been in AFib, regardless of how many years, ablation is still worth a discussion with EP.
I think the most important thing is everybody needs a discussion, a fair discussion, not a tilted discussion, risks and benefits, long-term success.
Speaking of success, and I'm curious about an elephant in the room, and I'm curious if you read about this, you know, how successful are ablations in getting patients to sinus, and think, how do we give patients a heads up, especially because it's a procedure and people have questions about that?
Yeah. So I was reading that some studies say that the success rate can exceed 80%, particularly in those who have paroxysmal AFib, but sometimes, particularly in those who have longer standing AFib, it can be as low as less than 30%.
The worst thing that can happen right after an ablation is if a patient goes right back into atrial fibrillation and thinks, you know, this procedure was a failure. And it may have been, they may need another ablation procedure down the line. We certainly do redo ablations.
And one thing Dr. Pruskowski brought up is that even if ablation is unsuccessful, there might be other benefits to ablation.
So for example, you do an ablation and they go back in AFib, but not uncommonly after you've done an ablation, antiarrhythmic drugs work where they didn't before. If you go in there and you wall off the veins and you do a few other things if you may need to do it, and then they come back in AFib, there's not as much... there are not as many areas that could promote AFib anymore. And now an antiarrhythmic drug that failed previously can work really, really well.
Okay, so ablation opens up the door for antiarrhythmics to work where they didn't before. And even if that means you didn't achieve the goal of getting them off meds, you're still able to get them back into sinus.
Ah, as we said before, sinus is superior. I feel like that's tattooed on some electrophysiologist's chest or somewhere. Someone has it tattooed somewhere. Sinus is superior.
Another bonus with ablation is that it's a chance for patients to get off of medications.
A lot of patients, particularly the younger patients who are super bothered by their brief paroxysm of AF, they would much rather have a procedure that is very safe at this point. It's a day procedure. They would very much rather have that than be obligated to taking even metoprolol, which is honestly like patients' worst. A lot of patients hate metoprolol. It is the worst thing. It makes them feel fatigued. They can have nightmares. They feel foggy. They don't think clearly. They feel limited when they're exercising. So it's a quality of life measure that I think we at least I underappreciated before I started sort of joining this field.
Yeah. And after covering those side effects of antiarrhythmics like vertigo with flecainide, I don't blame patients for wanting to get off these meds.
And what I've learned more and more is that patients hate medications. So if you tell them you could potentially take fewer meds after doing this procedure, 9 out of 10 people say, sign me up. But then you tell them about how this procedure could save your life. They're like, I don't know if I'm really interested.
Okay, I see why patients would want ablation. But are there people who we shouldn't recommend for ablation?
Let's say they have severe COPD. There are times when you have to say to yourself, is this the right patient to take to the OR, to a lab and put them out for 2 to 3 hours? You know, they're under general anesthesia. So it's truly a case-by-case basis. The vast majority of patients are candidates for ablation. But if you say right up front, there's no way that I think this patient will benefit from sinus rhythm, then ablation would be inappropriate.
Okay, so if patients are not safe for anesthesia, might be best to not refer them for ablation when the risks of a procedure outweigh the benefits.
And also, Shreya, there's an increased risk of stroke in the first few months after an ablation. So patients need to be able to take anticoagulation. And if they aren't anticoagulable, ablation may not be appropriate.
Ah, good to always bring up upfront. All right, so before we finish the episode, let's wrap our head around this pearl. Ablation is a complex decision that should be had with most, if not all, patients with AFib.
We don't have to wait until they failed medications before we try ablation. Ablation up front has been proven to be more effective than medications in achieving sinus rhythm. It's actually a class 1 indication for upfront use in patients who have symptomatic paroxysmal AFib or those who have heart failure with reduced ejection fraction.
Nice. And on that note, that is a wrap for today's episode. Please share this with a colleague or anyone else you might find helpful. Hannah's dad actually shared this with one of his colleagues, coworkers.
Yeah, he did. You just made his day, Sharia.
Give him a little shout out.
And thank you to our viewers, Dr. Robert Noss and Dr. Henry Hong. This episode was made in part from the Digital Education Tract at the IDMC. Thank you to all of our mentors who made this possible.
Thank you to Dr. Patia for the audio editing. Opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliated institutions. Thank you.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.